The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another live program of the Heretics Hour, Monday, April 16th, 2012. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours. A reminder that tomorrow is the deadline for U.S. income tax returns, in case you have forgotten that. Mine is already taken care of, but I wanted to mention this because, you know, what income tax return means is that Americans must return a part of their income to the federal and state governments because our legislators unconstitutionally voted to allow government to usurp it. I hate and resent income taxes, which is an insane concept that has nothing in its favor. As soon as legislators are elected by us to represent us, they are no longer on our team, but become a part of the government team. Why? Well, I think because they make more money that way. Money is the highest goal, the greatest good to be desired, we have been indoctrinated to believe. But enough of that. I have a very busy program tonight, a lot that I want to say and a lot that I have from my guests tonight. So in the second half hour, I'll tell you, Chris Miller will join me. In the first half hour, I'm going to be reading from the fire again. And I will allow phone calls from the listeners in the last 15 minutes that Chris is on between 9:45 and 10 o'clock Eastern time so that you can talk to Chris if you want to. And then in the second hour, I'll be doing my topic of wolves among the sheep. So my reading tonight starts on page 155. Oh, I'm going to me and my glasses problem here. We're now in the third chapter, the long one that I told you about, which is titled Land. It's divided into North, West, South, and East. Starting in the North tonight, I'm going to read about two cities only, Lübeck and Hildesheim. Lübeck is in the far north along the coast on the Bay of Lübeck, which is part of Mecklenburg Bay, separating Germany from Denmark. Hildesheim is farther south, but still in the north part of Germany, because it's just a little south of Hanover, which is one of the northern major cities. So it's a completely interior city. So I will begin. In the mid-ninth century, an exemplary city law was established in Soest that had effects far beyond its borders. It was adopted in Lübeck, a city at the vertex of the Baltic Sea. Lübeck, in turn, became the model for a string of cities along the Mecklenburg and Pomeranian bays and the Gulf of Danzig, all the way to Königsberg and Revel. These ports had far-reaching connections to a base of cities bordered in the south by a line linking Breslau, Erfurt, and Cologne. In the west, Amsterdam was part of this league, which maintained offices in Norwegian, Bergen, in Bruges, and in London. It was called Hansa. You know, that's spelled H-A-N-S-A. Hansa, from the old High German for military troop or band, giving the old world a northeastern area of civilization that held together for 500 years until it destroyed itself in the 30 Years' War. The shift in world trade to the Atlantic and the rest of the colonial system left the Hanseatic urban landscape and its less hurried times behind. The town halls, cathedrals, storehouses, cloth halls, and harbor facilities held on to the boldness and brightness of their youth. Its architecture, with its cool, sharply cut facial features, occasionally moved by a sated smile, is named after its dark, earth-toned skin of baked clay bricks. Lübeck was built entirely of this material, which after the city experienced devastating conflagrations, proved most secure. Its early creations, the cathedral and the Church of St. Mary, wedded the dizzying sandstone fantasies of French cathedral Gothic with the down-to-earth balance of the brick masonry. Derived from the Church of St. Mary are churches in Kiel, Rostock, and Stralsund, dedicated to St. Nicholas, the patron saint of seafarers. 3 centuries worked on St. Mary's, the main church in Rostock, consecrating it to eternity. That is, it was 3 centuries in the building. It was continued to be worked on all that time. Now I'm going to skip a few paragraphs and continue here. Lübeck had to fall. We're talking now about the bombing. Lübeck had to fall on the Saturday night of March 28, 1942, within 140 minutes, the crews of the Wellingtons and Stirlings were told, because it was an important seaport that supplied the German armies in Norway and Russia. Lübeck's famous son, Thomas Mann, spoke to the Germans via radio from California, telling them, quote, "There were fires in the city, and I shudder to think that the Church of St. Mary, the magnificent Renaissance town hall, or the old Seamen's Guild house have suffered damages. But I think of Coventry and have no objections to the lesson that everything must be paid for," unquote. As some of you probably know, Thomas Mann was the famous novelist who was very anti-Hitler and pro-Jew. Jewish, he was married to a Jew, Jewish woman, and he left Germany, went to the United States, and from the United States he gave broadcasts for the U.S. Government into Germany, trying to undermine the German attachment and the German loyalty to their government. So, you know, I used to like, I read just about all of his books and work, short stories when I was at a certain age in my 20s, and I thought I just loved him. And now, of course, I think totally differently about him. And I didn't know all that then. Think of all the years we spend doing things that later, if we had known, we wouldn't have done. But anyway, to go on, Hitler also approved of this lesson, and Lübeck's price was paid for with parts of the southern wing of the Exeter Cathedral's choir and monastery buildings of the Canterbury Cathedral. That is what Germany bombed in return for the bombing of Lübeck. In a letter written on May 4, 1942, Mann reckoned with continued payments to be paid by the German cities. "If you thought of what they were about to face," he wrote, "about to face justifiably, necessarily, indispensably, then a mild fright will befall you." Well, he knew exactly what was going on, Mann, and he thought that the Germans had to pay the price for what they had been doing with their National Socialism. All right, continuing, 36 hours were needed in Lübeck to understand what had been done to obstruct supplies for the German army. Quote, 80% of the actual old town was destroyed. Cathedral, museum, Church of St. Mary, Church of St. Peter were all destroyed, unquote. The Dornier Aviation Works, on the other hand, which was important for the war economy, remained intact, because this attack served less as a reprisal than to improve the state of bomb technology used in the Coventry raid. The Germans had demonstrated a model with potential. So the British had to figure out what that was. The Air Ministry in London considered it a secondary success that production in Lübeck had been restricted for 6 or 7 weeks and that 2,600 people had been killed. This was a sevenfold exaggeration, but that was not the point. The fire war, the experiment that had been in hasty preparation since the fall of 1941, had delivered a promising success. The old town in Lübeck had withstood far more than had initially been assumed, but the demise of the oldest quarter around St. Mary's, with the majority of the gabled houses, could not be measured by percentage points. Well, that's all I'm going to read about Lübeck, so I can go ahead and read about Hildesheim. And I'm going to start on page 181, and I will start now. The residents of Hildesheim, like those of many German cities, thought the bombs would spare their city. People there had a great liking for the enemy countries. Many emigrated Germans had participated in the American Revolution, and there was a tradition of friendly relations between England and northwestern Germany. And finally, no one would intentionally damage Hildesheim, world-renowned as a place of interest for medieval culture. For the U.S. 8th Air Force, however, Hildesheim was a train station that happened to have a city surrounding it. In early 1944, the residents shook their heads at the hedgehoppers diving onto areas like the sleepy train station in rural Honersum, and were incredulous when bursts of machine gun fire rained down on Dürnberg station along the train line between Grossdungen and Dürnberg. They thought it must be an emergency reaction of bombers being pursued by German fighter planes. But worse was yet to come. On Sunday, November 26, 1944, the Altenbecken Viaduct was attacked, and in order to ruin the potential detour route at the same time, the 8th Air Force headed for Hildesheim. They flew as a large formation that day, with 1,818 bombers and 3,000 tons of bombs, and fought one of the larger air battles of the war. The 8th Air Force had two primary targets, the Altenbecken and Schildesche viaducts, as well as a handful of alternative objectives, such as the marshalling yards at Ham, Osnabrück, Gütersloh, Bielefeld, and Hereford, and seven targets of opportunity. Hildesheim was a target of opportunity. Now, a target of opportunity is when, if the pilots cannot find their target for one reason or another, which does happen because particularly if they're in the latter part of the formation, there's a lot of smoke and fire and stuff going on, which can interfere with their vision. So if they get off course or whatever, they should bomb something else, and they have a few other targets which they should try to do before they just drop their bombs anywhere. So it says many buildings at the old market were hit because Hildesheim was a target of opportunity in this raid. And most surprisingly, one bomb had such force that it tore out a heavy tree stump 2 yards long and weighing 200 pounds, and hurled it from the old market over the buildings and onto the cathedral courtyard right in front of the statue of St. Bernward. Now, the next couple paragraphs are about Bernward and how he built the cathedral and all that he did in that area. And I'm going to skip that because I can't read it all and continue after that with this. The three reverend bishops' churches, St. Mary's Cathedral and the churches of St. Michael and St. Godhard, the wooden-framed buildings of Hildesheim in the artistic sense that Bernward brought to Hildesheim, were described by Ricarda Huch, who visited the town before its destruction. Next to and below the cathedral, close to the Roman this is Ricarda Huch writing. Next to and below the cathedral, and its Roman Catholic, though often also diversified forms of life, the German people grew up in stillness. The preference for the vertical drives, okay, The preference for the vertical drives the walls, poles, gates, and windows ever higher, storming toward the infinite, while the Romanesque church binds the formed symbols to the earth. Just the fact that the people's favorite material was wood brought a profound difference, alive, pleasant-smelling brown wood in which the roaming Germanic imagination could indulge with the wood-carving knife. Once again, I'm going to skip a little bit and start up here with the raid. The first systematic raid on Hildesheim took place on February 22, 1945, at 1:30 p.m. This was then after the raid on Dresden. It was also the date of the second operation against the Altenbecken viaduct. The focus of the raid was the freight depot. A wild churning up of the destroyed embankments, wrote Hermann Seeland, the cathedral canon. He continued, a chaos of chunks of earth and stone blocks, bare remains of iron rods and iron walls of burnt-out, overturned railroad cars. The train facilities in the north and southeast were the bomb targets, but they were certainly not the only ones. He listed the streets that had become one big pile of rubble and mourned the Lamberti Church of 1473, of which only the base of the tower and remnants of the nave walls remained. The interior of the St. Magdalena Convent Church for Augustinian nuns was burned to the ground. Excuse me, I'm going to get a drink of water. And here's a quote, I guess from this Hermann Seeland, the cathedral canon. St. Michael's Church must be mentioned as one of the very badly damaged buildings. Bombs that fell on the former monastery grounds, which were probably intended for the Ordensburg Germania, established by the Nazi Party, destroyed major portions of the northern wing and the eastern transept. Actually, it's good that the Ordensburg Germania was saved, if it was, because it's quite a wonderful piece of architecture that was put up by the Nazi Party. All right, continuing, for years, everything still standing in the country had been considered part of the castle of the Order of Germania. This became true for Hildesheim on March 22nd, when Bomber Command liquidated the city in 18 minutes. And with 235 airplanes and 446 tons of bombs. Thus, in a span of 11 consecutive days, Würzburg, Hildesheim, and Paderborn were razed to the ground in a grand total of 58 minutes. The American raids of March 3rd, March 14th and 15th, those 3 days, in 1945, had already dealt with the freight depot. Several hundred freight cars were dented up and the surroundings had been plowed. Bomber Command was also in search of undestroyed cities. Until those fateful 18 minutes, Hildesheim could have been considered among them. Afterward, 85% of the built-up historic areas of the city had been pulverized. On February 22nd, the bombers concentrated on the new part of the city, but Bomber Command had firm procedures. An old town built totally of wood was part of the repertoire. That is, they were more interested in bombing the old town, the historic town, than they were in the newer parts. Now, I'm going to skip again. I might, how am I doing? Yeah, okay. I think this will be about right. From the demolished cathedral tavern, we're still in Hildesheim, from the demolished cathedral tavern, Seeland, the man I mentioned earlier, ran to the St. Anne Cemetery. Before he left the city, he wanted to check its condition. Quote, what terrible devastation to this once beautiful, restful site, that is the cemetery, where emperors and kings, bishops and scholars sojourned in reverence for the past, unquote. The former chapter authorities had used the high attics of the cloister to store grain, but attics, including this one, had become the most dangerous places of all. His glance scanned upward to the open sky, the source of all the ruin. The graveyard crosses had been loosened by the hail of wooden beams and stone blocks flying through the air, covering the graves in layers. It used to be possible to see the cathedral tower from St. Anne's Chapel, but now no golden dome shines in the sunlight of a spring day. Today, March 24th, 1945, he wrote. It was the golden dome that Bishop Gerhard had promised the Virgin Mary if she granted him victory over the bishops Dietrich and Albert of Magdeburg and Halberstadt, as well as Magnus, Duke of Brunswick. Now Brunswick, Halberstadt, Magdeburg, Hildesheim had all perished within 5 months in the same fire. St. Michael's was a torn open ruin. High explosive bombs had ripped away the northern crypt and crypt ambulatory with the vault and the transept gallery, but they could not damage Bernward's sarcophagus. Except for a corner of St. Godhard's church, the wooden ballads of Hildesheim's half-timbering have left the earth, including the most beautiful market square in the world. The steeply soaring Butcher's Guild House, the Knocker Hauer House, had been praised by Georg de Hio as the most monumental of all wood frame buildings in Germany. It brought together Gothic and Renaissance styles, and it burned down like tinder. The cathedral was one of the most damaged in all of Germany. The scorched thousand-year-old rosebush at its apse soon started sprouting again, which gave many hope. The city of 72,000, built around a train station, was swept away because it was presumed there was a military necessity to shut down the Paderborn-Hildesheim rail line, as it was the only line leading out of the Ruhr Valley. And the city around it presented an opportunity that would not exist 46 days later to bomb an old town one last time, a victory lap of sorts. The train station was totally demolished. Hildesheim's human losses amounted to 1,736. The destruction of Hildesheim did happen. The city, this city and others in the Weser region had stored layers of all that had happened up to the time of its destruction. People, buildings, legends. The cities revealed them, even today, sometimes as replicas, but mostly as scars, the burn layer of their last destruction. Another subjunctive is whether the fires were absolutely necessary. Did Hildesheim have to be wiped out because of the train station? Was that the reason? Was there ever a reason? Did the fire raisers, in their resolve and rage, want to win at all costs? And is this the price that was paid so they could be victorious? Without a doubt, it was an attempt to win, no matter what the price. If Allied history does not depict this as a tragedy, then does German history also have to view it as a total success? Will this simple equating of destruction with success remain when, though things have not yet reached that point, the Germans become aware of their burn layer? The burn layer is a fact without words for it. I'm not real clear exactly what he means here, but I think it is beginning with if Allied history wants to see this destruction of Hildesheim as a success, does German history also have to? And up till now, German history does agree with Allied history that it is a success. German history has to be Allied history. This is a kind of this is more of a tragedy. This is a crime that a German history is sees its own destruction, the destruction of all this historic, and I mean historic, back to the 10th and 9th century of German life, of the German way of life, and all that they had created as a part of a success that brought a better world to us. And the burn layer, I think, is the Germans have not yet become aware of how burned they have been and what all this burning did. Friedrich Wax is pretty poetic at times. Now, the last short paragraph here is, tactical appropriation of history is an empty complaint, though one even lodged by Goethe. Whoever appropriates history is an active subject and thus subjective. There is also a history that no one appropriates, such as that of the Great Fire. But that non-appropriation and unwillingness is just as active, just as subjective. The not wanting, the unwillingness of two generations explains why so much time has passed. It is not the time to appropriate that past, but time changes, and it also changes how the past is appropriated. Well, that's the end of my reading, ladies and gentlemen. Just in time, and pretty interesting stuff. This is from Lord Friedrich the Fire. I'll be back with Christine Miller in about 5 minutes.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Israel has refused entry to dozens of activists who arrived in Tel Aviv as part of an international campaign dubbed Welcome to Palestine. 9 Israeli activists have also been arrested. The organizers say they plan peaceful activities like planting trees in the West Bank, and they've criticized Israel for overreacting. Let's get on top of this story with RT's Paula Stasius in Tel Aviv. Hi there, Paula. Are the activists still arriving? What's happening tonight? What's the picture then?
Well, we are receiving reports of more foreign activists arriving later on Sunday. So far, 45 international activists have arrived, the majority of them being French nationals. They have been barred entry from Israel, and at the same time, they've been detained at Ben-Gurion International Airport. Now, of the 45, 29 have already been taken to Ramle prison in the center of the country, from where, according to the Israeli police spokespeople, they will be deported. The remaining 16 are still at the airport and will be put back on flights later on Sunday to be returned to their home countries. They are part of this international campaign that has been dubbed Welcome to Palestine, and the intention of this campaign is to highlight the plight of the Palestinian people. There have also been 9 Israeli activists who arrived at the airport to show their support for their foreign counterparts, and they were arrested after holding up signs that said Welcome to Palestine and shouting slogans such as Free Palestine. There was a small counter demonstration by a group of Israelis who shouted at them, go home, go to Syria, what are you doing here? Essentially what the activists are saying is that this is a peaceful flotilla. Its intention is to really hold peaceful demonstrations in the West Bank. They were planning to meet with Palestinian families, to plant trees and to gather in Bethlehem. And they say that this flotilla, which is the second such flotilla in 2 years that they have tried to organize, is also an attempt to highlight the way the Israeli police and the Israeli authorities deal with activists or foreigners coming to Israel who hold political views not shared by the government.
Okay, but indeed they are banding, they're saying that they're a peaceful activist, they're doing nothing wrong, there's no violence here. So what have the Israelis had to say about the Israeli authorities about why they appear to have taken such a strong stance over these people?
Well, the Israeli police have been preparing for this already now for several days. There were 450 uniformed and undercover police throughout the day at Ben-Gurion International Airport. And to cite them, they were there to control the situation. The Israeli police accused these activists of provoking the situation. They said that they were intent on disrupting public disorder and that they really were trying to delegitimize Israel, particularly by holding up signs that say, Welcome to Palestine. But the activists accused the Israeli authorities authorities of violating their right to freedom of speech. At the same time, they point out that Israel...
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Christine Miller, who has now joined me from Wisconsin. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Well, Christine Miller... listeners, is a real heretic, so and she really fits on this program. That's why I like her so much. She has just finished running for school board in her town of Marshfield again, and we're going to ask her all about it so she can tell you. The election is over. So, Christine, first tell us how many times you have run for the school board, and then tell us about your experience this time.
Well, I must, gee, I don't, I started at least maybe 15 years ago, and naturally some people might like to make fun at me because I'm eternally running, but what they do not realize, I do not run in order to win because that's not possible. When I run for school board, I have to be given a voice. They cannot shut me up. So this time, in the past couple of years, the library put up a board, and everybody can put their messages up there. And actually, also, the Marshfield News Herald has to print what I have to say. And the voice. I'm giving a voice. And I would recommend anybody out there, run for public office. It doesn't matter what, but you will have to be given a voice. The voice is important. And that's all I have to say. I would encourage anybody out there, run for mayor, run for alderman, run for school board, any office. But you can say what you want to say.
Yeah, well, you have done a good, you have made a good connection because before you ran for school board, I think you tried to get some Holocaust revisionist books in the libraries in Marshfield, and you did manage to talk the public library into accepting some of them.
Yes.
And, but you couldn't get the school libraries to take them.
Exactly.
And you have also pointed out that they have around somewhere between 100 and 200 Holocaust horror story books in the high school library, right? What is that number?
I think 115.
I have it right here in this thing. It says 107.
Okay, 107. The library number is 940.53. That deals with the Holocaust. Now, what really bothered me, what I found out recently, is that not only do they have Holocaust books in the junior and senior high school libraries, they also have the Holocaust books at the elementary schools. Mm-hmm. And they start with the first graders. And I find that, are you versed in the Bible?
Yes, pretty much, kind of.
Okay, do you know what Jesus said? Do not corrupt the little ones.
Yeah.
And vote to that person who corrupts the little ones.
Yeah, that is the worst thing, he said, kind of like.
Yeah, and again, that is what they are doing. And again, these Holocaust books in the elementary schools, first of all, is they work with fake pictures. One of the most common fake pictures is the picture where the Germans were supposed to have cut off the beard of the Jews. And that's all of them. There are a number of these pictures. And every one of them is a forgery. It's a montage. It's put together.
Okay. But before we get into the pictures, which I know you're really interested in, but let's not lose track of the school board election here. So, and I think people are really, really interested in this because, we would all love to have somebody like you running for school board in our town. It must be, you know, great to watch it, and see what happens. Now, tell us, how the voting went. And it's already taken place. How many votes you got and how many there were altogether?
Well, that I'm very unsure about that because I called City Hall and asked them, how many votes there were. Okay. Now City Hall, there were five candidates. Okay. And three positions. Okay. See, all the old school board members were re-elected. And according to the City Hall, they got about 2,000 and a few votes, each one of the three who were elected. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I got 436 votes. Now I increased my votes. I forgot. I didn't look it up. I think I must have increased my votes for about 100 more votes this year. Okay.
So you got about
436 votes I got.
Yeah, but last time you got about 100 less than that?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
I have to look it up, yes. So I have increased my votes. But I think the Marshfieldians, by the way, 72% of the Marshfieldian population has German ancestry. Mm-hmm. But they are so afraid of being politically incorrect. They are so brainwashed into the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. They love it. Let's face it.
Really? That's terrible. Well, look at, let's make the point that you got 436 votes. That is more than a lot of people would expect for you to get because there were letters to the editor after after the newspaper, your local newspaper, printed up your, write-up that you had put in the library about why you were running. And it was all about the Holocaust books in the library. Plus, you addressed a few other issues, and you had answers for those. And so then there were two letters in the newspaper. One was from a rabbi, Dan Danson, who said that he hoped that nobody would vote for you, that you would get zero votes to deny you to deny your campaign of hatred, even a single vote. And then the other letter was from a Murray Brilliant, who do you think he's also Jewish. Yes. And he said pretty much the same thing. He said your fanaticism and denial of historic fact illustrates that you're unfit to serve public office, let alone set public school policy, and underscores why we need to teach our children about the Holocaust.
Yes.
And so these people are writing this stuff, and yet, in spite of all that, 436 people decided to vote for you. And even though they won't stand up for you outwardly, I think that says a lot. I imagine that really upsets Murray.
Oh, yes.
Murray Brilliant and Rabbi Dan.
Oh, very much so. I mean, there used to be a previous a Jewish doctor in the Marshfield, and he lamented the fact. Well, first of all, he gloated that I just got so few votes. But then he lamented the fact, why did she get any votes at all? Mm-hmm. I shouldn't have gotten any votes. But I want to point one thing out about these two letters against me by Rabbi Danson and by that other Jewish
Murray Brilliant.
By Brilliant.
What a name.
I want to point out one thing is missing. I mean, did you, Carolyn, did you notice what was missing in these two letters?
Well,
no, you did notice it. I tell you what was missing, the gas chambers. So the gas chamber stories is passé.
Oh, yeah.
And now it's a genocide by bullets. So.
Yeah, they don't say. They just, we hear this one, the Rabbi Danson.
Yeah.
He said, many more of us had close family, you know. Left Germany. They left Germany in the 30s. They weren't anywhere around there. But he says, but many of us had close family who systematically were murdered by the SS. Personally, he says, my mother's grandparents were killed by the SS Einsatzgruppe and death squads in the Ukraine. Oh, come on. He is completely making that up. And, you know, you and I know it.
Yeah. Something else I want to mention, you know, in the Ukraine, what you have in the Ukraine, you had mass starvation in the Ukraine. And that naturally was done by the communists, because they collectivized, they wanted to push all the farmers in these collectivized farms, and they took the foodstuff away. So you have that mass Ukrainian starvation. I think there's a name for it, the Holodomor or something like that.
Holodomor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's more likely that
his mother's grandparents.
Yeah, died from that in that starvation than from the SS. I mean, that is absolutely.
And how does he know here in the United States how his mother's grandparents died way back then? Your mother's grandparents are pretty far removed from you, you know.
Well, of course.
But you know what? I want to open the phone lines for just the next 15 minutes for callers.
Okay.
I should have announced that at the beginning of this segment, but I forgot. So, listeners, if you want to call in and talk to Christine and ask her anything, that would be the only reason I would want you to call in now is to talk to her. Do so at 1-855-477-2283. The lines are open for you to call. All right. If there's anything more that you want to say about your school board election, are you going to run again? When is the next school board election?
Next year.
Oh, every year they have one.
Oh, yes, every year.
Well, then they kind of stagger who has to run again for their seat. Is that the way
yes,
it works?
Yes, yes. Yeah. I think every 2 years, okay, the term is a 2-year term.
Okay.
And then they're up for re-election.
Well, you keep going, and wouldn't it be great if you actually got enough votes to win? Then they would probably be trying to get a recall, like they always do if the vote doesn't go the way they like.
Oh, yes.
They
yes.
don't accept it. Okay, there was another topic we were going to talk about. And that is this Frank Wallace story,
yes.
which interests you, and it interests me, too. And if nobody calls in to ask about your election and so on, we'll just continue with this. And it also brings in Simon Wiesenthal, who is, you know, what he did to this Frank Wallace. I just learned about it today from you, but I just think it's just so despicable. It makes I get so angry. I actually get enraged by these people. And of course, he's dead now. But and you know, he was Wiesenthal was exposed by this writer, British writer, who didn't do a very good job of it. He did more than well. He did a lot of
harm.
You mean
Irving? No.
I can't think of his name right now. I know his name very well, but I can't think of it right now, but it doesn't matter. he exposed him as just basically a liar who had lied about
him. Oh, yes, yes.
But still tried to say that Guy Walters, that's his name, Guy Walters, still tried to say, you know, still accepted, because otherwise he wouldn't have gotten his book published, I guess, that Wiesenthal did something that needed to be done, and that was to expose that these Nazis were being left alone and were not being chased after and hunted down and prosecuted, and this needed to be brought out, it needed to be done, blah, blah, even though he was a big liar. Anyway, you know, my topic tonight is wolves and sheep, and Wiesenthal is definitely a wolf. He's not in sheep's clothing, he's just a wolf. But according to the Chicago Tribune, this is a story that you have that was written in 1874.
It's a story at Tribune.
Okay, this is from the the Wikipedia. I don't know why they say 70.
Oh, okay. Now, the story came out in the Chicago Sunday Tribune, and it came out in 1984. So that is the article when it was written.
Okay, right. That's right, because we were looking for it. So I don't know why it says 74 here. Anyway, it turns out that this whole thing got started because Simon Wiesenthal contacted the Justice Department and accused this man, Frank Wallace, who was a Catholic Polish-American who was born in Poland, had worked in Germany during the war, and then immigrated to the U.S. after the war. He accused him of being a Nazi war criminal, and it was all based on gossip and hearsay. But because this Wiesenthal at the time was so prestigious, that Wallace was prosecuted and convicted. But then he, on appeal, he was found to be innocent. So tell us, you tell us about this story.
Well, Wallace befriended a Jewish family, and then he had a falling out with them. Because apparently they owed him money and he wants the money back. And then
This was in Chicago, you mean?
That was in Chicago, right. And
why don't you give his history first?
No, first of all, Frank Wallace, he was not born in Poland. He was born in Germany of Polish parents.
Oh.
And then they went back to Poland.
Okay.
And when the German army, conquered Poland, so they asked if anybody wanted to work in Germany, and they had, the Poles flocked to that offer. Okay, so many Poles went to Germany to mostly work in farms, because the husbands and the sons of these farms were soldiers.
So these were not slave laborers. These were not forced laborers. These were voluntary workers who were paid, right?
But first of all, they were paid. They volunteered. They were enforced. They had plenty of them for volunteering. And naturally, nowadays, they are called slave laborers, and they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And they were covered under the national health care system. So they got the free health care. So anyhow, Wallace volunteered and came to Germany as a youngster. He was very slightly built, and he came to my area where I was born.
Okay, he was 17 years old, right?
17 years old, very slightly built. And the family was not happy with him because they wanted a man and not a boy. Mm-hmm. And then they found him another place where he did just fine as a boy. And so anyhow, he immigrated to the United States. He married, and so he befriended that Polish Jewish couple, and they denounced him then because he wanted his money back. And so anyhow, and then actually the office of OSI office, the Office of Special Investigation, jumped in. And the Office of Special Investigation, I think it was founded by Holtzman. Okay, as another Jewish woman. And so they jumped in and they accused him. Well, naturally, then what they did, the Office of Special Investigation, they advertised in Israel for witnesses. And they got 12 witnesses. These witnesses, I mean, the lurid stories, what he did, I mean, said, Wallace, he in Poland, he was part of the Gestapo. He killed, his wife and the children with his pistol and all these stories.
Well, here's one savage act that came out against him, that he stomped a young pregnant Jewess to death. You know, that's the kind of thing that they like to come up with.
Oh, yes. But again, he wasn't there. I mean, he was at that time, he wasn't Germany.
Yeah, and this supposedly all occurred in Poland and by the Gestapo, yeah. Which he was an officer in the Gestapo at the time. And he was just a young guy, so he couldn't.
He was
Polish, so they wouldn't have let him into the Gestapo.
Okay, he was a youngster and very slightly built. So they got the record from the National Health Insurance. But the Judge Hoffman, the Judge Hoffman, also Jewish, didn't accept it because he said, look, these are Nazi records and they are not valid. And then, naturally, the priest of that community where he lived testified that he was there. Another French prisoner of war who was working there testified he wasn't in Poland, he was in Germany at that time, and the family testified he was with them, but naturally, as far as Judge Hoffman was concerned, these are all Nazis, and it didn't count for anything. And so he was convicted, and then there was a retrial. But he really wasn't kind of exonerated. It was the accusation that just dropped.
Well, you know, he was, yeah, and here's the money part. He had court costs of $60,000 after his first trial. And then when he went on appeal, he won the appeal. They dropped the whole thing when the judges there, the judge saw that the whole thing was a farce. And they dropped it, and they gave him $34,000 in legal costs to pay his legal costs. But Wallace told a reporter later, a good reporter, that he spent about $120,000 to clear his name, and all he got back was $34,000.
And naturally, when his case was dropped, his name was never cleared. They didn't say he was innocent. So that's what made him very, very upset, that the case was simply dropped and he was not cleared. And, so he was ostracized in Chicago. He was maligned and, it was a horrible life for him because, you know, they all said, okay, well, he's just a Nazi, Gestapo, et cetera, et cetera. So his life was ruined.
What is that? All right. And we're almost, we're close to being out of time. All right. He died of he had multiple heart attacks before he finally died. So this was very stressful, and it kind of ruined his life. And here's the thing that I found so interesting, really sickening. Wiesenthal never had to pay Wallace anything, and he even sued Wallace and the Cleveland Plain dealer for having had the temerity to complain about the kind of shotgun tactics that Wiesenthal had employed. So, you know, Wallace and the Cleveland Plain Dealer, had, they had written about, he had talked about, he had complained about the tactics Wiesenthal had used, and he had, he's saying that Wallace made him fall into discredit with those persons with whom he had contact. Well, that's exactly what he did to Wallace. We have a caller, and we have 1 minute left. Hi, caller. You want to say something to Chris?
Yes, I do. This is Olaf Childress down in Philly.
Well, hi, Olaf.
Olaf. Hi, Olaf.
Okay, Christina. Okay, I'll make this short. I'm looking at your latest article for the First Freedom here, in which you write, our youngest son in third grade at the public school came home crying every day.
Right.
Because he was mercilessly bullied for having a German-born mother. That leaves me. I fought back, complaining to the teachers. There are not many of us. It is a lonely position, almost amounting to ostracism. In the U.S., fighting back is still possible.
Olaf, we're going to go to the break in just about a half a minute. So,
all right.
Short. There we go. Christine, I want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing with us again.
Caroline, can I say one more thing very quickly?
I don't think you'll get it in. All you can say is good night.
Okay, good night.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Feature story news in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The UN Security Council has adopted a strongly worded condemnation of North Korea's failed satellite launch last week and is threatening further sanctions. US Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, says the Security Council statement is clear and unambiguous.
The international community is united in sending a clear message to North Korea that such provocations are serious and totally unacceptable.
Nathan King has more from FSN's bureau at the UN in New York.
The statement is much stronger than diplomats have been indicating it would be. Not only does it condemn North Korea's alleged satellite launch, but warns against any nuclear tests, and most surprisingly, paves the way for additional sanctions on North Korean companies with links to ballistic missile technology. The statement also promises current sanctions will be strengthened. North Korea is already under a strict sanctions regime, which allows for nations to inspect all cargo coming into the country, has asset and financial freezes on many North Korean entities and individuals, and a near-blanket arms embargo and severe restrictions on luxury goods. The statement comes as the new North Korean leader warned over the weekend that he would continue to put the military first and says his country will not be blackmailed by the West. Nathan King, New York.
And there's more from Nathan on Twitter. You can follow him there at Nathan King. English Premier Football League player Fabrice Muamba has been discharged from hospital less than a month after suffering a cardiac arrest during a game. From FSN's London Bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
Fabrice Muamba is standing and smiling in a picture released as he was discharged from the London Chest Hospital. In a statement, the 24-year-old praised the dedication, professionalism and expertise of medical teams who worked on him at White Hart Lane in an ambulance and later at the hospital. He says he is forever in their debt. Bolton's club doctor had described Fabrice Muamba as having been technically dead for 78 minutes after he collapsed. The former England under-21 international fell to the ground before half-time in an FA Cup tie last month and was given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and 15 defibrillator shocks before being rushed to hospital. Ollie Barrett, London.
11 U.S. Secret Service agents being investigated for allegedly consorting with prostitutes last week in Colombia, ahead of President Obama's visit to the country, have had their top-level security clearances revoked. FSN's Malcolm Brown is in Washington.
The agents have also had their service equipment confiscated while multiple investigations continue. The unfolding scandal centres on allegations of misconduct, including the alleged use of prostitutes. The story overshadowed US coverage of the summit in Cartagena and has deeply embarrassed an agency which prides itself on quiet effectiveness.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You know, I forgot in the last half hour to mention Chris's website. She's got a new or updated website. It's at cbmiller.com or .net, either way you go. It's been redesigned by Mr. Bill Fink, who is a good website designer, and it's quite nice. And I do encourage you to go there and see it. I did want to bring that out. So it's different. It has a lot more material on it, and they will have more material coming up. So do keep that in mind and check that out every so often. Her letters to the editor are just fantastic, and you can also order her books. She's got two books that she has published. So now I want to announce that I'll be taking calls in the last half hour of the show. We've got 1 hour left, and I don't want to take calls this half hour because I have to present my material, and as usual, I have more than I will have time for, but I'll therefore just get started right away. In the U.S. today, we know that Jews control our media. They control book publishing in Hollywood. I really don't need to go through all this list of everything that they control because it's already been covered so many times. You know, and on the Internet, the biggest presences are Jewish-controlled outfits like Google, Facebook, Wikipedia. And the idea that I want to present here as a preliminary is that Jews have huge power. And since we know that Jews do what is good for Jews, we know that they don't want us to do what is good for us. But the hitch here is in the common white person's understanding as to whether they see Jews as us. I mean, this is where it's all at. I've talked about this before. That Jews are not us on previous Heretics Hour programs, both with Tan Staffel and with Bill Fink and others. It's a very important theme. It can't be overemphasized. But when we talk about wolves and sheep, when we talk about wolves in sheep's clothing, we have to understand that that Jews are not us, but many white people have a real hard time understanding this or wanting to believe it or wanting to say it or talk about it. Now, I was real happy to see just yesterday a new essay by Greg Johnson at countercurrents.org, I think it is, titled Our Fault with a big question mark. It was posted on April 12th, which was just 4 days ago. And he makes it crystal clear that he is now convinced that Jews do not belong in white society because they are not white. Now, Greg is a white nationalist. He uses that term for himself. And at the beginning of the essay, he links to Tan Staffel's several blog posts at ageoftreason.com on the suicide meme topic, going all the way back to 2008 when Tan Staffel first started with this. And the suicide meme from Tan Staffel and Our Fault from Greg Johnson Both refer to the idea, which is given common currency, that whites are responsible for our displacement problems in our own homelands. And we blame ourselves and our own weakness rather than recognize the real perpetrators, who are the Jews. So coming out and stating openly that it's the Jews is not something that very many white leaders can do or are willing to do. As of now, they would rather continue to blame whites for their own problems, to blame us for our own problems. They are white too. They are white nationalists. Many of them call them that. And yet it's still, we're still only supposed to talk about ourselves and not talk about the Jews. So that said, I think it's important to talk about this predicament and to open it up, so to speak. So, in this program, I'm calling all of us white folks the sheep. We know that most sheep are white, though some are black. And that doesn't mean that they're Negroes. It means that they're black sheep in the traditional meaning of the term is someone who's somehow out of step with the rest of the herd. And in this analogy, we can, instead of the herd, we can think of the tribe. Call it the tribe, we are downplaying nowadays this great worship of individuality, which has been so prominent through all my life in the mainstream politics and with the way we were taught about things and in the idea of democracy for good for every individual can do whatever they want. Type of thing. And we are emphasizing now more the collective because, the other is the kind of, is not protecting us from this kind of displacement that I mentioned and that we're all familiar with. So as we know, wolves are out to eat the sheep and, down to the very last one if they could. So in other words, they rather than actual eating, we could, the analogy is to eradicate the sheep. Or at least make them invisible and inaudible. That is to shut us up and to make us not seen. That is white people who have feelings about being white. Now this last, invisible and or inaudible, is what I'm going to be talking about tonight. And I'm going to start with a recent event that was hailed as a big success for white nationalism. And that is the American Renaissance Conference held in mid-March at a national park facility in Tennessee. The March 16th Friday show, right here on VOR, which was exactly 1 month ago today, devoted a large space of time to congratulate Jared Taylor and tell him what a great guy he was. And then James Edwards, who was a speaker at the conference, had Jared Taylor on his political cesspool radio program last Saturday, during which he addressed Taylor at least three times as the incomparable Jared Taylor. What I'm getting at is the great honor that is bestowed on Jared Taylor by other white nationalists. All of these people so far mentioned call themselves white nationalists. So now it's good to stand up for our own and to encourage and praise our own people who are working for white interests. But there's some strange things that occurred about this American Renaissance Conference, which have come up after the Friday show, but before last Saturday when James Edward had Jared Taylor on. And I'm gonna go through some of this as quickly as I can. One of the speakers at the Amerind Conference was a Jew, a Professor Robert Weisberg. Now, that's not unusual for Amerind and Jared Taylor, but the thing is that Weisberg spoke against white nationalism as a movement in his speech. The title of it was A Politically Viable Alternative to White Nationalism. And Weisberg argued in his speech at the conference that any movement that is explicitly based on white racial identity is, quote, dead on arrival, unquote, and must be repackaged in order to win successful recognition. But I ask, recognition by whom? Who are we trying to get recognition from? Well, Jews and Jewish media, of course, and the general public out there but they just follow the Jews and the Jewish media. I would say we're trying to get recognition from Jews. We're trying to get them to allow us, according to Weisberg, to have some kind of white identity without it being explicit, without us having an explicit white racial identity. He said that white nationalists, and he included himself as a white nationalist, Weisberg did, because he said we are considered just above child molesters. Well, maybe, but the point is he included himself when he is surely not a white nationalist, and he made this clear a week or two after this conference when he was involved in the firing of John Derbyshire. Now, to me, his double speaking makes him a wolf in sheep's clothing. He also said any white movement today that takes an explicitly racial stand will fail. He also added that there is no economic advantage to promoting white racial consciousness, and most people do not act without financial incentives. So then again, you know, very Jewish. It's all about money, and we, of course, everybody wants money. They're concerned about financial affairs, and there's no economic advantage in white racial consciousness. So we shouldn't be following that. We need to do something that's going to help us to be more successful, which is what? Well, that's a question. I want to point out that Weisberg was invited. And was he paid to give this speech? Well, at least I guess his expenses would have been paid for his going there and his lodging and so on. I really don't know how that works. Maybe some people are paid and some aren't, but he's not really that in. So I don't know why he would have been invited, but that's the question. But he was invited by Jared Taylor and his partner, Henry Wolf, who some people might know him, but I tried to find out something about him, but I couldn't. Find out much of anything, and not a picture. So he was invited to speak at this conference, yet what he said contradicted the mission statement of the AMREN website, which is under what we believe. They say under what we believe, race is an important aspect of individual and group identity. Okay, but Weisberg said that race couldn't be a part of our identity because we, you know, an explicitly racial stand will fail. So what's even more amazing is that Jared Taylor was not bothered by Weisberg's speech. And still, after he said what he said, which I'm going to come to next, he doesn't seem to be bothered by what he said afterwards. Now, so what did come next was that John Derbyshire, who was not at the conference, but he's been to many of them, or, you know, earlier years, but he was not at this one. He happened to write an article that got him dumped as a writer for National Review magazine, which is supposedly a right-wing magazine, but of course it's basically a neocon conservative magazine, Jewish run. But this is I say that he got dumped because he himself has complained that he doesn't like it to be said that he was fired, because he said he wasn't employed by them. He just offered them articles, and they often or usually took them and paid him for them, But so they just dropped him. Shocked by this, then Weisberg was also dropped. Simply when it was discovered that he was at that AMREN conference and had given a speech. Now, this shocked Weisberg, and he protested to a journalist that his speech was anti-white nationalist and that he was a 1960s colorblind liberal. He even called white nationalism obnoxious and said that he told them at the conference, you'd be better off calling yourself a child molester. I quoted that. He declared to this journalist who wrote it all down that he was not a white nationalist, and that he said when the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, he joined the crowds dancing in the streets, celebrating it. Now, Weisberg said Rich Lowry, who, as I said, is another Jew who is the editor of the National Review, was engaging in guilt by association. He was being found guilty because he was at the conference and spoke, but he wasn't in, according to him, he wasn't at all in any kind of agreement with the people at the conference. Now, after saying all this publicly, Jared Taylor, I have not heard any criticism from Jared Taylor about Robert Weisberg. He's more concerned about the fact that John Derbyshire was dropped by Lowry and the National Review because he thinks he should still be writing for them. Another thing about Derbyshire is that he's married to a Korean woman, has been for a long time, and they have two children, which are half Asian, a son and a daughter. So, and he has said, I read it, he doesn't hide it at all, that he is more comfortable with Asians than with whites. He walking in a room full of people, if they are Asian, he feels more comfortable than he walking into a room full of white people. Now, is he a white nationalist? Well, I don't think he actually calls himself that. But I would say definitely no. Now, let's go on to the political cesspool from last Saturday night. Now, this is, I'm not trying to tear into people here, but this is interesting, and I think it's instructive of why we say that Jews are not white and why we need to act accordingly. Okay, in the first hour, I listened to it because I had found out that Jared Taylor had been on the program. In the first hour, James Edwards actually brought up the Robert Weisberg anti-white statements to Keith Alexander, who he always usually has on in the first hour. And they talked about the fact that he was Jewish, especially Keith did, and about the things that he said and how really awful it was what he said about when he was, after he was dropped from the National Review, all the terrible things he said about a white nationalism and the conference. So then the first half of the second hour, James Edwards brought on Jared Taylor for what he thought, I think, would be a straightforward discussion of the Weisberg affair. And he brought it up to Taylor. And, well, I got that impression that he thought that's what it would be. But Taylor didn't pick up on James Edwards' cues about Robert Weisberg being a disappointment to him from all these things he had been saying. And so James Edwards didn't pursue it. Now, I see this as a serious fault of Edwards. He let Taylor kind of run the show and talk about Derbyshire, basically, and criticize the National Review magazine and Rich Lowry without criticizing, get all these people's names mixed up, Weisberg, for the things that he said. And he also called Taylor the incomparable Jared Taylor three times. So let's see, I already covered all that. Now then, James Edwards proclaimed that it was probably the best interview of the year so far, the 15 minutes with Jared Taylor. But to be honest, you know, I've heard Edwards say that often, though I'm far from a regular listener, but it certainly was not a good interview. I mean, there was nothing to it. It went nowhere. And yet they talked a lot about Rich Lowry and about neocons, Jewish neocons and so on. But is that a surprise that the National Review is Jewish, is been taken over by neocons? I mean, that happened a long time ago, but that they talked like this was some, the, you know, the news of the day. And it was a surprise what happened. So, okay. Now the second half of that second hour, after Jared Taylor left, Ted Pike came on and talking about the anti-Christian TV show, something, I think it title is Christian Bitches in it, which they're all a terrible kind of a show, and they're trying to get it canceled, trying to get the sponsors to not sponsor it. They've got 11 of them now who have dropped it, but somehow it's still going. And so during this interval, the word Jew was talked about again by Pike and James Edwards, and they had no problem talking about Jews, but Jews was never mentioned once during the Jared Taylor interview, the word. So his aversion to using or speaking about that word, the word Jew, tells me that when you can't mention Jews, and Jews are treated as one of us, you know you're dealing with wolves. And that's my stand. And it's not just Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor I say, let's see if there's something I need to add here first. No, I've already said that. Okay, Jared, in my opinion, and I could be wrong, it could be not quite that cut and dried, but Jared Taylor is a wolf. Jared Taylor is a wolf who is wearing sheep's clothing. He either really is a wolf, or he's just such a weak white man that that he functions in the same way as a wolf. And it's he and what he does is harmful to white nationalism. I know that there's a lot of people who think that he is helpful. He has his place. He doesn't agree. He's, with many others, he's not comfortable with excluding Jews or attacking Jews or talking about Jews. He's comfortable with talking about blacks mostly, and IQ and blacks and so on. He also accepts North Asians, as many of these people do. So they're not really white nationalists at all, but I think that they're thought of that way, and so they create a problem. I would say that by making Jews welcome in our midst, he aids in making whites and the white message less visible and audible. And the same goes for those who uphold him instead of calling him to account. So what we have here is that this is the idea that we can have a lot of variety and diversity in the white nationalist movement, and it'll still work. Well, why is it, I ask, that diversity, when it is multiracial, doesn't work for us? And if any of us ever thought that it might not be too bad, we certainly should have learning now, and at an accelerated rate, that it is deadly. And so if this diversity is not good, why is diversity in the white nationalist movement good? I mean, of course, we can't all be forced into marching in some exact step, but there should be certain rules, and it should be pushed. Now, I think I'm sure I did bring up what Greg Johnson wrote, yes. And now he's doing the right thing. He's coming along and saying the right thing. I just lost my place, folks, by going back and looking. But okay, here I am again. So I'm going to ask the question here. I just have a couple more minutes. What's the most important thing to say? Well, why Jared Taylor? Jared Taylor graduated from Yale University. He has very good manners. He's always courteous. And so people feel they must be courteous in return. And courtesy means you don't ask nosy questions, and you don't expect the other to say any more than they are comfortable in saying. And so, this somehow can be a kind of a protective device for him. And I would say that how did he manage to become a kind of like a distinguished master statesman of the white nationalist movement, which, and many people in the white nationalist movement bow and scrape to him, in a sense, as I already described. So how did he manage that? Well, my answer is that there's such a thing as longevity. And if you stay around and hold your organization intact long enough, you're rewarded with an aura of a solidity, of respectability, of trustworthiness, because you've kind of proven yourself, you've weathered the storms. But what storms has this particular person weathered? He lives well on the East Coast, I think. I understand, I'm sure. And he manages to put out a kind of fancy magazine every month for years now. Is this because he's working so hard at it, he's struggling? Is this his full-time job all these years? I would ask that because we know how many people try to do things and fail. So, you know, has he got a source of income for all this? Has he got a source of money? He probably collects a decent amount of money from donations, but how steady is that? So there's questions to be asked. And certainly after this business with Weisberg, they should be asked, but they're not being asked by anybody that I know of, except people who are not listened to. So here we go about that. You know, when you are cut off and made inaudible and invisible, well, then you don't get heard. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I've come to the break. When I come back, I'm going to turn my attention to the Holocaust revisionist movement and where I think there might be some wolves there. So, and you're also welcome.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Now, the bitter battle for French votes is intensifying as presidential rivals Nicolas Sarkozy and François Hollande hold Sunday rallies in Paris. The election is just a week away, and with immigration and identity taking center stage, Tessa Arcidia looks at whether France is witnessing a seismic shift to the right.
Anti-immigration, anti-euro, anti-globalization, and advocates of protectionism. All in the name of the French state and national identity.
There is not a single French person, not one European, who does not know that I'm a sworn enemy of the European single currency.
Parce que cet Islam radical...
Radical Islam is a direct consequence of mass immigration that the left and the right imposed on us for decades.
Traditionally on the fringes of France's national politics, the rhetoric of today's far right may no longer be as far off for its citizens as it once was. Opinion polls suggest that presidential candidate Marine Le Pen of the ultra-right-wing National Front Party is third with potentially 10 million votes, its biggest support base ever.
There is no policy of integration in France. So if you don't speak French, it doesn't bother anyone. But we don't want us to look like England, so we don't want to have different communities that don't speak together. Europe has an identity. Globalization destroys this identity.
Enter Le Pen with her calls for economic patriotism, prioritizing France over Europe, its native citizens over others, of giving the French back their jobs. And center-right incumbent Nicolas Sarkozy stands accused of jumping on the far-right bandwagon, some say for the ballot's sake.
Our integration system is getting worse and worse. Why? Because we have too many foreigners in our territory.
Threatening to withdraw from the Schengen Border Free Agreement, by no coincidence, at a time when Europe is seeing an influx of refugees fleeing conflicts in North Africa and the Middle East.
This is a pre-electoral shift, so we will have to see if he is re-elected, what he will do with this. Sarkozy knows pretty well that he was elected in 2007 only because he was able to catch the vote of the National Front. And now the situation is quite the same.
Some say that what was once a protest vote is now a more permanent part of the French political spectrum.
There is certainly a part of the electorate who vote for the reasons of dissent, but I think it must now be recognized, even if it's difficult to accept, that the vote for the National Front is increasingly a vote of support.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and this is the last half hour of the Heretics Hour tonight. So I want to welcome your phone calls. It is, the number is 1-855-477-2283. Once again, 1-855-477-2283. Well, as before I get into Holocaust revisionism, which is even more sensitive than white nationalism when it comes to talking about what I'm talking about wolves among the sheep, I want to reiterate that talking about Jewish power and how it is everywhere and how Jews do what is good for Jews, would be absolutely ridiculous for any of us to think that Jews are not moving in to all of our affairs, particularly when it comes to something like white identity movements. That they're not, and of course, revisionism and anything to do with the Holocaust and World War II, that Jews have not moved into that a long time ago. That their organizations, which are huge world networks of organizations, have not worked that out and dealt with that and don't have people on the inside everywhere. It's just ridiculous. It would be ridiculous for us to think that that's not so. But at the same time, we don't want to be suspicious of our fellows, and most of them there's no need to be suspicious of, and we don't want to be going around, casting the dire eye at everyone and not trusting anything, because then we wouldn't get anything done either. So it's a very difficult situation that we are in, but I think that we have tended to err on the side of being too trusting and not even thinking that that our people, let alone some of our well-known big names, would not be on the up and up with us. But I just think that it has to be that there's many that are not. So what I've been casting one of these dire eyes at some revisionist entities, and mostly I'm not talking about any big names. I'm talking about small names, actually. Actually ones I don't even know their names. They're people without names, people who have pseudonyms, which is common in the area of Holocaust revisionism. And one of the things there's two things I'm concerned about tonight, recently here. That is CODO, Holocaust Revisionism Forum, and the Winston Smith Ministry of Truth website. Okay. Now, I don't say that I know for a fact any of this that I'm going to say, but there's a lot of things that I don't like. And as you should know, CODO stands for Committee for Open Debate on the Holocaust. And the open debate, that's the forum is supposed to be a place for open debate. And yet it has, in my estimation, become one of the most closed places, one of the most censored, dictatorial places I know of. And I'm not accusing CODO Forum of being a wolf, but I'm accusing it of letting wolves run the forum, similar to the Buchenwald concentration camp, where Jewish partisans, who should have been executed but were not, instead they were sent to Buchenwald, ran the camp. Because the Germans were too busy fighting a war and they had too many other things to do. But I'm not saying they ran the camp from the top, but down in the ranks they were running things. And that was a known fact. But because in the same way, it seems like, well, maybe that's not a very good analogy, so I won't make it. But I became suspicious of the Winston Smith Ministry of Truth blog just in the past week when I discovered all the anti-Hitler posts he had there. Now, many are okay with the idea that, many of these posts are of the Hitler was a Zionist type. Now, that's a red flag for me, as you know. And so when I see too much of that, I start looking at the whole blog, and I found mainly that it was just very shallow. It's not a serious about any issue. It takes a sensationalist type of approach more for entertainment than anything else. For that reason, it's very popular. You know, the blogger is British, but that's all I know about him. It's evident that he has a high level of computer skills. He posts at a lot of forums and links to posts on his own site. But what is his purpose in doing that, I ask, because to my mind, it's rare that a loyal British subject, which he seems to be, cares all that much to debunk the Holocaust, that he would spend so much time at it. He posts every day and sometimes two or three posts a day. For example, I mean, he's got to spend a lot of time because today is the 16th of April, and he's already had 58 posts during the month of April. In 16 days, he's got 58 unique posts there. That's a full-time job, even for an exceptionally talented person, unless he has help. Now, maybe you think he might have help. Does he have a staff? Is he paid to do what he does? I'm very suspicious, aren't I? I'll give you a few examples, and then I will return to the CODO forum. He relies heavily on Mark Weber for some reason, and he mentions his name often and links to articles at IHR. Maybe he just goes there. But he doesn't ever link to VHO or Whale or other revisionist sites that are available. And he, of course, he never links to my program or my website, but that's okay. In fact, he's tried to prove me wrong on a couple occasions. At Scrapbook Page's blog last week, he was pushing the idea that Hitler vigorously supported Zionism from 1933 to 1939, even to the severe detriment of German interests. And he backed up the idea that Hitler was a Zionist with various links. This, you see, is what got me started on this. So I looked up his links, and the most important piece of evidence he was using was a 1976 paper from a Klaus Polk. Wait a minute, I learned how to pronounce his name, Poulkin. It's spelled P-O-L-K-E-H-N, but it's Poulkin. The title was The Secret Contacts, Zionism in Nazi Germany, 1933 to 1941. So I read the whole paper, and it's a blatant anti-fascist manifesto by an East German newspaper journalist who is what this Klaus Poulkin was until the Berlin Wall came down. He was in East Berlin working for the main newspaper there. And I'm sure he wrote this. It was 1976, so he wrote it for the Soviet communists. He wrote it in the spirit of that, and he was a part of that. I don't know what he is now. I don't know if he's still alive, but I saw a television interview, a televised interview of him, which was about an hour long, and he said in it, one thing he said both at the beginning and at the end, or it was in this paper, and maybe that I read, and then it was at the end of his televised interview. But he made a definite point, and it seems like something he says often, that he doesn't understand Germans who say they're proud to be a German. He made the ridiculous comment. He said, "What if my grandfather or father emigrated to the United States? Then I would be an American. Or if they emigrated to America, then I would be an American." So what is the deal about being a German, that you should be proud of it? And he then goes on to say that it's nationalism. He's very anti-nationalist, very pro-internationalism. He's just totally communist. That's what he is. So this document was set up for that, and I just think it's a fraud. So this really kind of angered me about this fellow who has this website, which is supposed to be totally about Holocaust revisionism. See, I wonder how someone who is so anti-Hitler can be so avid about exposing the Holocaust as a fraud. I don't understand that. I think if you really believe the Holocaust was nothing like what it is said to be, and you also are very anti-Jewish, which this website is, and this person apparently is, or pretends to be, then you wouldn't be so anti-Hitler and want to say that Hitler was a Zionist and one of the Jews, unless you are, the only thing I can think of is that if you're British, which he says he is, you are, and you're a patriotic Brit, then you still want to hate Hitler and you still want to make Hitler somebody who needed to be taken out in order to justify what Britain did in the war. And we have some people on the Cotto Forum who are British who express those very sentiments. They're honest about it. Anyway, I have not had the opportunity to question this Winston Smith. He goes by the name of Winston Smith Ministry of Truth website. But I know it's very popular, and I used to come across it every so often, you know, something linked to it, and I thought, well, look at this. This guy's really doing a great job, going to town, you know. But see, I never looked at it closely. And he might be, but he might have an explanation for this. If people are all different. But anyway, I would say that, okay, in the month of November 2011, I counted 8 anti-Hitler posts on his website, implying that Hitler cooperated with Jews from the beginning of his career. And that he insisted on continuing to send, a lot of them are about the transfer agreement and how he insisted on sending Jews to Palestine until 1939 and so on. And then he gets into the Adolf Eichmann doing all that too and all of this stuff. But now in all of 2011, he has a grand total of 11,351 posts. How many? I think of that. 11,351 posts. I don't know anybody who posts that much on their blog. What is the purpose of all this? Well, I say possibly to keep people hooked on him, because they can go there every day and they can find a couple new things, or maybe more than a couple. And they like to read things like that because it's very simple reading, very like, you know, don't have to be more than in the fifth or sixth grade to follow it. So as I said, that the blogs are not serious. There's no depth. You don't go very far with them. They're just quotes from here and there that he's come across. This might be it. Now on Friday, December, here's an example I'm going to give you, and then I'll be done with this. On Friday, December 23rd, 2011, he posted an article straight from the Guardian. United Kingdom, you know, The Guardian, you know what kind of a paper that is. They love to go. They're always posting. They're always printing Hitler articles. They have probably one or two a week, kind of like him, you know, in which they tear into Adolf Hitler in one way or another. And this one supposedly quoted Hitler's doctor, Theodor Morell, who somebody had written something about him at that around that time, saying that Hitler had a split personality. So the big headline in The Guardian and that this website had was, you know, Hitler had a split personality. And The Guardian makes the most of this by adding and insinuating that, you know, adding and insinuating to it. But a Winston Smith blog posts it without any commentary. It just leaves that ridiculous, not very honest article there as is. And it leaves a bad impression toward Hitler, even if you realize that it comes from The Guardian and it might not be very truthful. Still, there it is. And this kind of anti-Hitler idea runs all through his Holocaust and anti-Jew blog. It stands out because, like so many others who happen to be British, including a small, well, it stands out to me, sorry, because it's like so many others who happen to be British, including this small group of Brits on Code of Forum, which I'll go to next. Now, the poster, I have a lot of difficulty with this because I feel like on the one hand, I don't feel real good about saying these things. And on the other hand, I think they need to be said. And so I can't talk on the forum. You know, I left the forum voluntarily because I had a big spat with the moderator. And then I was banned after which I found out when I tried to contact someone on there through the, well, they have this system where you can have a mail, you can contact another person on the forum and talk to them privately. And, I tried to do that with someone on the forum and that's when I found out that I was now banned. So now this is the second time I, Carolyn Yeager, have been banned permanently. And then a couple times I was banned for 2 weeks, well, more than a couple of times, 2 weeks or less, although the last time the ban was lifted after a couple of days because I wrote about it on my own website. And now I'm talking about it on my radio program because I can't talk about it anywhere else, and I can't say what I'd like to say there. And if I did say it, my posts would be deleted and I would be banned again. So you see, there's no point. Now, the point I want to make is that CODO has always had been founded on the whole idea of free speech. Free speech. Bradley Smith is all for free speech, and he's always associated with libertarianism. I don't know if he is a libertarian officially or not, but he kind of likes that type of political stand. and I know that that he's totally sincere in everything, but the forum he doesn't concern himself with at all. It's in the hands of this moderator and I guess a webmaster. And the moderator has maybe over time become more dictatorial and repressive than you can imagine, because there's very few people who even want to post on CODO Forum now, because he has lately deleted so many people's posts and banned so many people that now they're becoming timid. You know, they don't want to say anything because they're going to upset him. He says that he's doing this because people are breaking the rules. And he always says, and he often says he does it because somebody used inappropriate language. But in a couple of recent cases where he said that, I had read the post before it was deleted, and I didn't notice any inappropriate language. And I know my last post that was rewritten a little bit. That's what got me so mad. Because it had, and I was warned about inappropriate language along with someone else when I did not know of a single word that was inappropriate, so I asked him to please tell me what was the inappropriate language I used. And you know what? He deleted it and told me he was not going to tell me. He said that right out there on the forum, and therefore I should just know what it was. Now that just got me. That got to me too much. I couldn't do that. All right, Hadding is here on the air. Hello, Hadding.
Well, I think you haven't lived until you've been banned from a forum.
Well, I realize being banned from a forum is not a big deal. I'm not really complaining. I'm not complaining about being banned from the forum. I'm just saying that this forum is not allowing real debate any longer. But the thing is that there is a favoritism seemingly to be shown to a few people on there who I think and they have the same anti-Hitler attitude. And when people challenge them about anything, not necessarily that, but about their weak revisionism, because they also express a lot of pro-Jewish attitudes, and their revisionism is kind of, let's have some revisionism, but let's not go hard on the Jews. Let's be easy on the Jews. And when that has been addressed, not attacked, but addressed or challenged, one of the other things that they've said, but when they've been challenged, it's always been about revisionist points. Then the person who's challenging gets in trouble, and they never do.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the problem is that this is what you get when you have kind of a big tent. You end up with a kind of lowest common denominator view dominating everything. And a lot of the traditional propaganda ends up being perpetuated just because most people are not very good at critical thinking, you know?
Yes, they encourage newcomers. Newcomers are okay, but the people who have been there for a long time have all disappeared, and they're the ones that get in trouble. It's really, you know, my concern is that I think it's a shame for this happening to this forum. And my overall look at it is that, once again, somebody may be, if not directly instigating this, well, I think some of these posters might be instigating it, but the moderator, in order to not make it difficult for himself, goes along with a lot of this. I don't think that the moderator is a wolf, but I think that the moderator is weak and is going along with stuff and is therefore, so that not to have any arguments or anything, even a little bit heated, even a little bit, they just cut these people off and let these newcomers come on and say the same old dull stuff, that everybody already knows about, I've got some good examples here, but I've run out of time. I wanted to mention Borgesdick, as the one fellow who brings up a lot of anti-Hitler posts and is very suspicious that he does so much of it. And I was going to actually read some of them, but I guess I won't. You can't blame the Jews for this, you can't blame the Jews for that. And you really think that the Jews didn't suffer? You really think that such and such, and a lot of Jews didn't die? And you really think all this? And when people try to go after him, he gets all angry. He says that they're being unfair, and the moderator supports him. So
yeah, well, it sounds like he's got some people moderating. You know, I never bother with any of that stuff. I hardly ever look. I have like one or two things that I look at on internet, and the rest I don't bother because it's just a big distraction. There are a lot more, you know, weak-willed and wrong-headed people out there than there are critical thinking and strong-willed people. You know, the people that are the really righteous people are a very small minority. There's a lot more error than correctness out there. So I just ignore all those people.
Well, I don't miss being on it either because it wastes my time. You know, you can.
It is a huge waste of time
on this stuff. Yeah, so it's really better. But I've still been following it and following what some of these people, and that's when I see these things going on. And I have to, you know, you do have to wonder, what do you think of the overall thesis that that we have a lot of interference in our movements, and that's why we don't get anywhere? I mean, I think Cota Forum could be a fantastic place, but it's not.
Yeah. I want to say about Taylor. I think with Weisberg, I mean, I understand what he was trying to do there, I think. But I think Taylor made an error in judgment by letting Weisberg pontificate about whether white people should represent their own interests. That was going above and beyond what's proper. You know, a Jew has no business going to a function like that and expressing his Jewishness like that. Unless somebody's going to be allowed to discuss the issue from another perspective.
Well, right. And now if we've got only 60 seconds left, Hadding, but if he... If Jared Taylor is so smart, which he is, why doesn't he handle that kind of thing better? Why didn't he even do it to begin with?
I think he's playing a very difficult game, and in this instance, he fell down. He made a bad decision.
Well, you think it's going to have any repercussions that are permanent or long-lasting, or it's just going to be forgotten about?
Well, it makes his position more difficult, but it's hard to see how his position could not get more difficult over the long run when he's trying to ignore a question, you know? Somebody at some point is going to bring it up. It's been brought up at various times, like Donahue brought it up about 10 years ago. And Jared Taylor had to lie a little bit in order to get out of that when he was on the Donahue show.
Okay, he was on the Donahue show, huh? All right,
yeah,
well, he's been around for a long time. Well, thanks, Hadding, and thank you, listeners, and we'll be back next week for another Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.